Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Do you ever see a successful woman on your feed or in a magazine and think, wow, it must be nice to have it so easy? Well, think again. Behind that glossy cover or smiling face is a ton of hard work, countless failures, and endless learning experiences. I'm Rebecca Minkoff, and I'm here to tell you that success isn't a walk in the park. It takes grit, resilience, and a willingness to take risks. That's why I created Superwoman, a podcast that peels back the varnish and gets into the nitty-gritty of what it takes to make it as a woman in today's world. From luminaries and game changers to women you've never heard of but should, this podcast is here to inspire you to take your next leap, no matter how daunting it may seem. We'll explore the sacrifices these women have made, the highs and lows they've experienced, and the lessons they've learned along the way. So if you're ready to be inspired and learn from some of the most successful women out there, join me on Superwomen. Together, we'll uncover the stories behind the successes and prove that with hard work, determination, and a little bit of luck, anything is possible. Hey everyone, you're listening to Superwomen. Today's guest is Miha Agrawal, the founder and CEO of Silk & Sonder. She launched her company out of a deep desire to start writing down everything that was going on inside her head and found it to be incredibly therapeutic. Cut to an incredible, thriving community, Silk & Sonder is used by so many people to plan their goals, put their dreams out there, and everything in between. Take a listen.
So welcome back to the podcast. For those listening, we recorded an incredible episode and then the studio just lost the files and could not recover them. So here we are again. So let's dive in. Tell me about, we'll obviously get into Silk & Sonder, but I would love to hear kind of your early days. Yeah. You know, where did you start? Because no one would think you'd end, you know, where you are today.
Amazing. So I guess my story starts at the very beginning, born and raised in Santa Barbara, California. My dad's a professor of computer science. My mom also worked at UC Santa Barbara. And they were, you know, immigrants from the late 80s from India. And so you can only imagine how that goes down, being the first daughter of immigrant parents. Achievement is just ingrained into the culture at a very, very early age. But, you know, I remember my first 5 years, it was all about play and learning and curiosity and joy and so many of the things which we'll get to later on how I try to incorporate my days even as a CEO that I am now. But, you know, it was 5 years, just us as a unit. And then my sister was born. I went to kindergarten. Of course, my parents made me learn multiplication tables and cursive right before kindergarten, thinking it would give me a little bit of a start. Maybe it gave me too much of a start. And so I think, you know, I joke about it because I love playing with Barbies. I love playing with pattern blocks, but I also love math and art and, you know, a lot of that analytical creative brain power that I think I enjoyed through my early years. When I got to high school and college, you start to shut it down, right? Because you end up choosing a path. And so for me, being a daughter of South Asian immigrants, I had four choices of what success could look like. You know, hint, fashion and being an entrepreneur was not one of them. So both of our stories would have been deemed unsuccessful back in the day. But, you know, jokes apart, I ended up deciding between academia, engineering, law, or medicine. And I chose engineering. I studied computer science and business. And that really started my career as a software engineer and product manager.
So let's go back because, you know, being that your parents were immigrants mm-hmm. and that they were of the career mindset that they had.
Yeah.
There was no, you mentioned, oh, I just want to be an entrepreneur. Like that doesn't exist. I mean, maybe now it does, but less so for our age group when you, especially you have immigrant parents who are like, you're going to make something of yourself. It's going to be doctor, lawyer, scientist. Go.
Yeah.
So what was that like when you were like, maybe I don't want to do this?
Yeah. So that I would say didn't happen until my mid-20s, right? Because I was so used to operating outside my comfort zone. I think with a computer science degree and a business degree, it was kind of like this mindset of, if I can do it, I should do it. I got a job at Goldman Sachs. Then I joined the startup industry. Then I worked at Stitch Fix. And then here I was in my mid-20s, where suddenly I was thinking about, whoa, I've checked all the boxes. I've built the safety nets. I've gotten the gold stars. Now what? Because I'm waking up underfulfilled and I want to do something different. And so, you know, I think that was more of an inward search first and foremost, because I'd learned my lesson of, you know, asking my parents for advice, because the advice was always the same: go to graduate school. And I got into graduate school, but I chose not to go to graduate school. So, you know, I started to realize that there was no point asking others for guidance. I had to really figure that out for myself. And so that led me down this path of, you know, researching, reading a ton of self-help books, because I'm more of that go-getter type. So therapy just felt not really accessible nor my jam at that time. And coaching was extremely expensive. Meditation was boring. And I loved personal development, you know, books and research and articles, but I was missing that accountability factor. And so started to connect the dots there. And that was my first kind of wake up moment of, I need to be doing this. You know, this is where I get lost. I spend my weekends saying no to friends and researching all this stuff and then trying it out and figuring out, oh, you know, this gratitude thing seems a little hokey, but let me try it. And then you notice this magical shift to your emotional health. And so that was the first time. And what I did was, I was very quiet about it. I decided to keep my naysayers away. I decided not to tell everybody that I was working on this side project of mine. I literally made a promise to myself to see if I could get one person to buy Silk and Sonder in its original form, that wasn't a friend of mine. And then I would go and tell everybody that, hey, I've chosen this path of being an entrepreneur. You know, I think everyone talks about the financial risk of chasing your dreams, being your own boss, being an entrepreneur, but they don't talk about the emotional risk of not trying. If you've got the entrepreneurial bug, you are almost like putting the world at a disservice by not pursuing it, because you're cut from a different cord. And so I think the moment I started to hang around other entrepreneurs and notice that we were all kind of similar, we were okay working in unstructured environments, that's when I knew that this has always been the path for me. And then I can kind of go unveil it to everybody else that maybe never thought that this was my calling.
What was the point where this, you let the drive to succeed and start your own business overcome the fear?
And oh, great question.
What was also, well, no, I'll get there. What was that moment?
Yeah. So I distinctly remember that Silk and Sonder was a side project. Maybe we had 500, maybe 1,000 paying subscribers by this point, but I was fulfilling everything as a nights and weekends project from my apartment in New York. My then boyfriend, now husband, was rolling around with those bell carts that they give you to USPS, because USPS does not pick up from your lobby in New York. You've got to do it yourself. And I remember, you know, I had an offer from Bonobos actually at the time for a product manager role. I just, you know, left my other job, and my husband, my boyfriend at the time, we were in Tulum, and he just looked at me and he's like, why do you keep building more safety nets? You've already created them. You can go back to being a product manager. Hell, you could even go back to being a software engineer. You could go back to graduate school. You've already created the bed of safety nets that you need. Why do you keep delaying the opportunity to be, in his words, a real CEO, right? You know, ever since we've been dating, I've been dabbling in these side projects. And he said, why don't you just give yourself a timeline and see if you can make something of it, decide if you want to fundraise, do all these things. And it was that moment where someone who loves you but kind of gives you that advice, that hard advice, and isn't even criticizing. Really, he's just kind of reminding me of my worth and opportunity, and he believes in me. And I was like, what am I doing? So I went back to Bonobos and I was like, hey, I'm going to start this thing. And they're like, okay, let us know if you change your mind in 6 months. And that was the moment where I decided I'm making these promises to my early users. It's time to actually deliver. And so I quit my job, decided to, you know, give myself 6 months and make a decision on fundraising, try to grow the business, and pay myself a salary by the end of those 6 months. And fast forward, I think within 6 months, I started with the pre-seed round. So made that long-term decision, I guess, ever since.
So you said that you had 500 subscribers and you're shipping everything at your home. Like anyone, that would be like a first year goal for any, or, how did you get them? How did you even get the word out? You're working full time. What was that process like?
And it's interesting because I actually made the decision to fundraise when I reached 1,000 paying subscribers. I don't know. I had these arbitrary goals. But in the early days, we did everything that everyone is told to do, right? You tell your friends and family, you post on LinkedIn, you post on Facebook, you go into these little groups, you do everything that doesn't scale but is cheap to do, right? And so that's how we got our initial set of, I would say, 50 subscribers. Most of them were friends. But then what was fascinating is that our friends would then post on Facebook. And, I don't think they were actually the diehards of Silk & Saunder. They were just supporting me. But what was awesome was when they would post on Facebook or they would take their journals to their, some of them went to like church groups or whatever, different physical groups that they had or to work, and their colleagues would be like, oh, what is this, journal thing that you have? And that is what led to that second cohort of users, which were way more fascinating to me. And that was friends of friends. And from there, I started to figure out that there were some people organically finding out about Silk & Saunder, writing about us in the blogs. And then I would see traffic coming in from the blog. So I would go talk to that, individual who wrote about us. And, it was just really getting super close with your customers who are different than you. I remember one lady, her name was Megan. She emailed through the hello@silkandsaunder.com email address, which of course at the time I was managing for better or for worse. But she said she has adult ADHD. She has two daughters. Silk & Saunder has changed her life and makes her feel organized. It's new every month, so she doesn't get bored. And that's, I think, my moment, Rebecca, where I was like, I'm building something that's far bigger than I ever imagine, bigger than myself. This isn't about just solving my productivity problem. This is about solving an emotional health epidemic, which fast forward to 2023 and 2024, we're living in the loneliness epidemic now. And so it's almost the solution that I didn't realize would become more and more important post-pandemic, post loneliness epidemic that we're all facing. And it really is this journal meets planner, but beyond that, it's the community and the support that we've created for women across all walks of life that really makes Silk & Saunder work.
I think sometimes that just knowing you're not alone is therapeutic, like you
Yeah,
mentioned,
totally.
community, and being able to almost, like whenever I'm trying to problem solve, I call it like my mental Rolodex, which if you're Gen Z, you don't know what a Rolodex is. But to me, it's like a thing you spin, you're like, what's the solution? And you're looking for it. But what's nice about getting your thoughts on paper is it just helps to like put it there so you just are not like splattering in your head and focus. And
Totally.
even that in itself, I find, I'm a big list maker. If you saw my desk right now, it's just lists of
Oh,
things that I
lists
have
and
to do.
post-its, like even
Yes.
within my Silk & Saunder, I have like post-its. I'm like, this is defeating
Right? Every time
the
I start like a new notebook, it then gets filled with post-its. And I'm like,
yeah.
what is wrong with me? This makes
You know
no
what it
sense.
is? It's, I don't know
Oh.
if it's like the entrepreneur in us, but the post-its just gives you a little bit of that extra freedom. Like we care a lot about freedom and flexibility, right? So the post-it can be moved to next week. Whereas if you write it down, you have to do
Gonna,
it. You commit it, But one
yeah.
thing, Rebecca, I forgot to answer your original question on how did I find them. So in addition to friends of friends and posting everywhere and, talking to the people that blogged about us, the hacky thing that I did is I had a ton of friends working at Facebook at the time, and they all got $250 credit per month, and they weren't using it. They were supposed to use it to get to know how the advertisement model worked. And so I said, look, if you guys aren't using it, use Silk & Saunder as your guinea pig. So I had three or four friends, each giving me $250, and I was making informed guesses on who I thought my customer was based off of what, reviews I was reading and when I would user interview them. And so then that's literally what I did. I started to create ad creative for very specific targets. And then, of course, in those 1,000 customers, we had customers in every single state of the country because I had figured out how to talk to someone from the South versus someone on the coastal cities. And it was a very proud moment of mine. And I miss those days where we could just take advantage of credits. But that was the good old days of paid social.
Oh my gosh, there were so many good old days.
I know.
So What was it like when you had to tell your parents, like, I'm doing everything you didn't want me to do?
I feel like at the end of the day, parents, including immigrant parents, they want us to be happy, right? And so when you logically explain to your parents on how something is bringing you joy and it's also bringing you money, I think they kind of back off a little bit. Like my dad still gets a little stressed and thinks, oh, you should go get your PhD in psychology. It seems like you really like psychology. But I think at the end of the day, he's very proud that I chose a path that nobody in his life ever has. I mean, he comes from a family of doctors and lawyers, and so and he's a professor. So I think he's very risk averse, but he's a dreamer like me. So I think he appreciates the impact that I get to have and how much purpose is rooted in my work. I'm not doing it for other reasons. And so I think they came around. I think it was me being able to trust myself in the moments of biggest fear, right? Like there was a point, I never thought I'd be that person with $2,000 in my bank account, but I was that person. I was like, that'll never be me. But when you live in San Francisco with your rent, your savings goes like this. And so
Pre-COVID, when the rents are.
pre-COVID, yeah, exactly. So, I think it's like in those moments, instead of going to mom and dad and trying to get help them problem solve and freaking them out for no reason, you almost get into problem solving mode of what are my options? How do I fix the situation right now? And then you keep them away from those problems and you just bring them into the good times and then they get on board.
So when you had that moment of $2,000 in your bank account, which for some people that is a great amount of money to have, but not
Yeah,
when you're a
totally.
startup living in San Francisco,
Yeah.
and trying to, pay for your life. What made you keep going?
Yeah.
And what did you have to tell yourself? Like, I know that I don't have any money, but
Yeah.
I am on the right path.
Totally. Well, first of all, this was before I had raised my pre-seed round. So like checking savings was like quickly depleting. And so I think one thing founders don't always talk about is everyone's appetite for financial risk is different, right? There, I could have probably gone to my parents and asked for money if I needed it, but I didn't want to. So I, in that moment, decided, okay, I need to get through the next couple of months. So what do I do? I decided to just take a quick consulting gig with a previous company and just do that. It was a great project. I learned things and I was able to do it alongside Silk and Sonder. And that gave me enough of a cushion to have a few more months of personal runway. And so I think what kept me going is always the customer, right? I think that's even what keeps me going today is I think even when things get hard, when I read through Sonder Club, our community platform, or when I read the reviews, it reconnects me to my why and why I wanted to build Silk and Sonder beyond just like a little journal business. And so I think that kept me going in that moment. And then on top of that is I think being able to problem solve for myself at that moment. It was like, I don't need to justify this. I just don't feel good with money depleting and scarcity. So I need a little bit more injection. And that kept me going for 3, 4 months. And that's what I needed to be able to hone my pitch and get the first few checks in.
So, what was it like having raised some money? You now have people that have expectations. They want to make a return on their investment. Have you done your
Yeah.
Series A or just a pre-seed?
No, I've raised 4 million, so I've done a seed.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now you have people that are like, I'm taking a chance on you.
Yeah.
What was that like with your own internal pressure and then
Yeah.
adding that now to the mix?
Yeah, great question. And this goes back to that immigrant child story, right? So I don't know about you, but my parents, when the jogathon came around or Girl Scout cookies or anything that required asking anyone for money, my dad was like, I will write you, I'll give you the dollar per lap. Like, that's it. I'll give you $5 per lap. Don't ask anybody for any money. So it was very shameful. I wasn't part of Girl Scouts. I didn't get to practice that skill of selling. And so A, fundraising was very hard as a result. I had to really shift my mindset from I'm not a charity case. I'm actually building a real business with real customers and real revenue, which is more than a lot of
How did you
companies.
get over that? Because that's like a that shame
I'm
around
still
money, it
getting
is like a
over
really
it.
deep feeling,
It is
okay?
a
I still have
real,
it.
yeah, it is. You know, I'm still getting over it. I'm still not over it, right? I think it hits in phases. I think when I take a step back and see, wow, what have I built? Even if we're struggling, right? Even if times are tough, I think realizing the end impact, and understanding that, you know, the insights that we have on customers and the way that we can innovate and build this business to be 10x, 100x than it currently is, you just got to believe that you are innovative and you're not asking for money to throw away. You are truly trying to use that money to make this business bigger and better because you want to build this legacy brand that needs to exist in this world, right? So I think it's like forcing yourself to remember like the why and the purpose. Like you're not just, I mean, at least I'm assuming you're not just another company that's just trying to raise so you can throw money away. There are people that do that, and unfortunately, you know, hopefully investors can see past that. But yeah, I mean, I think for me, it was very much I think living in that scarcity mindset, I had to overcome it. So I think this was also very hard. Being a professor's daughter, being academically great, and teachers always validating my skills, I initially thought investors were like teachers. So I would like try to like give them, you know, report like updates because I felt like I was going to get a report card, right, or something. And so I think that relationship has shifted over the years. But initially, it was a lot of pressure and anxiety around, I said I was going to use this money for X, but what if I see something? Am I allowed to use it on Y? You know, like there's just so much internal conflict of what you said you would use the funds for, and then you use part of it, and then you're like, this isn't working. So like, should I shift it, or what do I do? Do I need to ask for permission? And so I do think it was like a very bittersweet experience. I remember kind of seeing the money hit the bank, especially after we raised from Redpoint. And so by that time, we had like 3, 4 million in the bank. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, I have to use this. You know, and I come from an immigrant mentality where it's like money is meant to be like saved under your mattress. Like you don't invest it, you don't do anything with it. And so I do think I had to slowly get used to being able to put that money for calculated risks. And you know, that's probably why we're 4 years in and still surviving, because I was careful, maybe too careful. But I think that mindset is tough, but you realize you need to just keep your investors in the loop and bring them into kind of the stuff that you're doing and build that trust. So that way, when you decide to shift gears or whatever, you don't necessarily need to ask for permission. You can inform and educate them on your learnings.
Would you say that you're being that your background in engineering and computer science, you know all about you can calculate risks. And then here you are an entrepreneur, which is inherently risk forward. How do you approach, and now you have the money in the bank, but then let's mix it with the immigrant mentality. Like, how do you calculate when and how to take a risk, especially knowing that you want to grow the business, you want it to be successful, people want to see a certain level of growth from you. How do you sort of take that soup and not be paralyzed?
So I think one thing being a computer scientist teaches you very well is how to solve problems in a lean way, but it still needs to be baseline excellent, right? If your code doesn't compile, the program doesn't run and you'd have nothing. And so you have to ensure that it works, which is another form of perfection. But I do think you can create the first version of something, which I call a minimum lovable product. So it's not minimum viable because that's janky and no one's going to use it. It's lovable so that you put baseline level of excellence forward. So I do think that comes in handy being an entrepreneur for sure. And then I think the being risk forward, I feel like the best entrepreneurs, they have key insight and they mix their intuition with kind of the humility of learning, right? So you might be very bullish on something. And so you do it, you build that MLP feature set or whatever. And then you also need to take a step back and kind of optimize and figure out, is this worth going further on, or do we need to pause it or shove it away? And so I think that blend is helpful for sure. And so I do think you can't just be hasty. Like, I don't admire the entrepreneurs who are just like, let's build, you know, blah, blah, blah. And like, it's going to be so big. And then they just waste all this money, as opposed to like, you know, I always give this analogy of like, build the skateboard before you build the car, and like every little like rim of the car, you know, like just focus on building small, but steady. And then double down, right? You want to build your Ferrari next? Fine. Like, figure out how to get there. So I think that's what I admired. And I worked at Stitch Fix. So I had a very different experience with being in a venture-backed business, because what I thought Katrina Lake did extremely well is, you know, she raised a certain amount of money, but she was so disciplined about the business model and about profitability and being a really sound business with or without capital. And so my philosophy with capital is that, it to the best of one's ability, you should just bring it in to be a growth injection, right? Like, help you grow and help you try new things. But you have to have a sound business model, and you have to be ready at any point to operate on that if you have to.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. I can't tell you how many people are bringing in money to like get to the MVP, or
yeah,
you know, just feel like it eases the pain. I'm like, no, it doesn't. Creates new pain. Oh, creates new pressure.
It's new pressure. And I think that's super interesting, because at the pre-seed level or even the seed level, a lot of people are able to raise on an idea, especially male counterparts. A lot of my male investors were shocked at how much work I was doing. You know, I was building a financial model. I was doing the cohort retention of 1,000 customers. You know, it's like not stuff that you normally do. But in my gut, I knew that it would make me a more sound operator. So it was worth the homework up front to get the right types of investors who are values aligned, who really believe in good metrics. And so I look at my founder friends today who have raised a boatload of capital, and they on one idea, they try it, it flops, or competitors emerge. And now they're like, Mia, how did you, like, I need to get to product market fit. And I want to work on this thing. And then they're like switching to another thing. And I'm like, oh my God, I didn't have that luxury, but that sounds like a different kind of pressure, right? I think when you have a cohort of customers and you raise, then you'll never fail, because you'll always listen to those customers to help you drive the roadmap. So that's my hot take.
Nope. I think it's 100% right. And when you see the landscape right now, especially in business and trying to fundraise, I think it's the only way forward.
Yeah, totally.
So where do you sort of turn off or never?
And no, I definitely turn off. Like, to recharge and rejuvenate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I say no to a lot of social things, although now millennials are like having kids and they're busy, and you know, I think things have shifted a little bit. So there's a different kind of loneliness emerging there. But I think I turn off in a way that's like active rest. So I like dancing, I like Pilates, I like, you know, those types of fun workouts, I guess, outside of the gym. So that's one way of turning off. And I found that, you know, there's this misconception that if you are going 100 miles an hour, you have to just like pause and like sit and calm down. And you know,
light a candle.
I love lighting candles. I journal every morning. So I have a very like consistent routine. I would say there are times where I like totally burn out. And that is when my head is hurting. I can't look at a screen. And I now have become better at noticing when that might happen. So I just cancel my meetings. The best part about having an assistant and a team that understands that I can just, if I need to take a Thursday afternoon off, I take my Thursday afternoon off and I like go get a massage. So I indulge in those types of self-care things. And then I would say, I'm very clear on my core values. So I make sure that my weekends are sacred and they are spent, you know, learning, reading, cooking, like doing things that bring me joy. But I also work on the weekend because it gives me peace of mind that if I need to take a couple hours off during the workday, I can, because I've kind of like planned ahead. So yeah, I don't know. I guess the turning off is different for everybody, but I love my Napa and Sonoma getaways, you know, even on like a Friday, I'll go.
I could use one of those right now.
Yeah.
I have 4 kids home in quarantine because one has chicken pox. So I could definitely use a break.
Oh man, chicken pox. Oh.
I know it's so rare to get it. I feel like I
Oh
won the
my
lottery. I'm like,
gosh.
yay.
Oh my gosh.
So do you feel like your approach to business, how are you shifting it for Gen Alpha, for Gen Z? It's a radically different mentality
Yeah.
approach.
Yeah.
How do you sort of look at that as the future of your business?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think a lot of our customers are millennials or boomers for sure. But Gen X, their children are now, Gen Z. And what we're finding is that there are these really beautiful mother-daughter moments. So mom is buying Silk & Sonder, mom's also engaging in the app, but daughter is noticing, like, what's that? I wanna tinker with that. And what we're finding is that I think watching mom do something and then trying it for themselves in their own way, they are extremely in tune with their emotions more than I think you and I ever were. And then on top of that, they are able to label things. Like, I didn't know what anxiety was. Like, I didn't, we didn't talk about that stuff. And so I haven't figured it out for Alpha yet, but I think Gen Z for sure is able to articulate what they need, or they're socially anxious, or whatever they might be feeling. And so Silk & Sonder actually has Sonder Blush, which is an entry point that's digital first, and they're able to listen to, audio reflections with journaling activities, and they're able to kind of connect with themselves by exploring different topics, for confidence or for personal growth or whatever it might be. And I think they like that stuff. Like, they almost seek out self-care stuff more than I think millennials do. Millennials are reactive, whereas I think Gen Z is a little bit more proactive. And what we're finding is this mother-daughter pair is really fascinating, or the friendships that are able to form with Gen Z doing Silk & Sonder, which is new for them, right? They have to force themselves to disconnect. And Silk & Sonder is great because the millennials to boomers, they disconnect first with their journals and then they reconnect. Whereas with the Gen Zers, they'll download our app, they're connected first, and then they're forced to disconnect. And I think they are starting to build those skills that maybe they didn't get to during the pandemic or before. And so that's how I think about it. Unfortunately, loneliness is hitting all of us in different ways. And so what boomers need is very different. Like, they love coming to our virtual classes. They love, like, the creative part. It almost feels like going to church, like, or temple. Like, it's very much that world. Whereas millennials just kind of want their quick, I only have 5 minutes, give me something to do so I can feel good and then, like, carry on with my day. And I think Gen Z, you're going to kind of see this shift back into this appreciation of disconnecting, right? Like, they
Yeah.
want to almost have the life that I think they didn't have because they were so glued to their phones.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. What a crazy. I feel like I'm in my fashion world, I'm seeing all of Gen Z like wear things that I wore when I was 16, and I'm just like, oh God. So it's interesting how it all flips
All
back.
comes back.
Like someone
Wait.
posted a Delia's catalog the other day, and like I
Oh
was like,
my
oh my God,
gosh.
everything from that catalog that I wanted that my mother would not buy me when I was 12, girls are wearing that
I
right
know, it's
now.
crazy.
It's
It's
wild.
crazy. It's
It's
wild.
wild. Well, thank you for being on again. Thank you for
No.
sharing. And this one will not be deleted because I'm in control.
That's a thing, right? That's what us entrepreneurs just need a little bit, right? One foot in,
Just one
control.
foot in.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Rebecca. It was such a pleasure, and I'm so glad that I got to at least meet you in person and do this again. It was fun.
I just wanted to thank you guys for listening to today's episode. I also want to ask you to rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. I know it's a pain in the butt, but it actually helps with search and algorithms. So if you love this podcast, it is an easy way to get it more visible and out there. I also want you to follow me on Instagram at Rebecca Minkoff, at RM Superwomen, and be sure to check out my book, Fearless, The New Rules for Unlocking Creativity, Courage, and Success. Thank you again, and you will hear from me next week.